Hi, I'm Philip Shepherd. It's my pleasure to welcome you to this amazing once-in-a-lifetime conference, and especially to the Meditation and Breathwork channel, which I'm proud to be sponsoring because meditation and breathwork are essential to my teachings. I'm the founder of the Embodied Present Process, or TEP, which is based on my two books and is taught worldwide. And here's one thing I believe about meditation and breathwork. You limit your experience of both if you imagine that your mind is just the thoughts in your head. Your mind permeates your every cell. Every stirring of energy within your body is an expression of it. So, if you wish to calm your mind, the most direct route is to develop the skills that enable you to feel the body's energy and ground it in the spaciousness of the present. That's what my work is about. If that appeals to you, I hope you'll check out my two presentations, one on this channel and one on the main stage. You might also be interested in a special offer exclusive to the Embodiment Conference to listen to one of my embodied meditations for yourself for free. You can find a link to the special offer in the description of this presentation or on the show notes. And now, enjoy the presentation.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Embodiment Conference, a panel discussion on monks and scientists discuss meditation. And my name is Miles Kessler. I'm going to be the moderator for this panel discussion. We are going to go right up to the hour, and we've had permission to go a little bit more if needed, which I'm sure we might take advantage of. It's going to be mostly a dialogue with the panelists. Towards the end, if you have questions that you want to write in the chat, that's fine, but put them, add your questions to the Q&A, and I will draw on the questions, the top elected question at the end, and we'll feed those to our panelists. In the meantime, allow me to introduce our four panelists that are going to be with us today. First, we have Ringu Tolku Rinpoche. Rinpoche is a Buddhist teacher and professor of Tibetology who teaches meditation around the world as well as participating in many interfaith dialogues. And Rinpoche is coming to us today from Sikkim. Next is Dr. Miguel Ferris. He is an experimental psychologist who specializes in the study of beliefs and spiritual practices. He is the co-author of The Buddha Pill, Can Meditation Change You? And lead editor of the Oxford Handbook of Meditation. Next is Dada Jyotirupananda. He is a meditation teacher, writer, and life coach based in London. He is the author of Meditation, Searching for the Real You, who teaches meditation around the world. Dada is coming to us from London. I believe Miguel is also coming to us from London, if I'm not mistaken. And finally, rounding off our panel is Dr. Daniel Ingram. He is a physician, a meditation teacher, and researcher. Daniel is the author of the cult classic, Mastering the Core Teachings of the Buddha. His primary focus these days is organizing researchers and other academics to study how to bring a functional awareness of the deep end of spiritual and meditative experiences to the clinical mainstream. So we're going to open up the panel with, first, welcome to all the panelists. We're going to open up with a two-minute opening statement about the topic of monks and scientists discuss meditation. We'll begin with Dada Jyotirupananda.
Okay, thank you, Miles. I often hear about how science and spirituality, and here I mean meditation when I talk about spirituality, I often hear how they're distinct from each other and perhaps they'll never meet. Let's think of some definitions though. Science can be defined as a systematically organized body of knowledge on a particular subject. Meditation by my guru has been defined as concentrated thinking. So right here, I see something in common. They both deal with the mind. They both deal with what I think of as rationality. Now, science has to do, among other things, with observation, research, and replication. That's partly how we come up with scientific discoveries, inventions. And meditation, as well as the bigger framework of meditation, which I call yoga, which we think of as yoga, it uses the same factors. The laboratories of science and meditation are different, but they both have laboratories. So while some may think that never the twain shall meet, I see that science and meditation have similar systems and purposes. Perhaps the main purpose is they're both looking for truth. Most science, by definition, deals with the natural or physical world. Meditation does deal with the physical world, proper posture, proper breathing, etc. But it is basically a gateway to the spiritual world. And how do the results compare between meditation and science? Well, I think we're fairly familiar with the benefits of science. For example, the internet that we're using today is certainly a benefit of science, as well as much of our daily lives. Yogis, in their own way, experimented to see if certain practices, when replicated from one person to another, could give similar results. Their purpose, of course, was to find, we might call it the inner life, the inner truth, peace, spirituality, whatever. And yogis built on the information in their labs also. Their laboratories, however, were primarily the human mind, as well as the human body. So they learned that the practice, what they practiced could be used by others to achieve the desired results. And they did this, as I say, through their laboratories and through replication. So I feel, in summary, that if modern science would embrace and explore meditation, I believe that we would learn more about how meditation could help people and how meditation could also be of a benefit to the world. Okay, thank you, Miles.
Yeah, wonderful. Thank you, Dada. And let's go over to Daniel Ingram. Daniel?
Hello. Well, that was all wonderfully said. So I'm just going to say thank you to the monastic traditions, the monks and nuns that preserved these things for thousands of years and taught basically all the people who taught me either were taught by monks and nuns or were, had themselves been monks and nuns and often obviously both. And so just like to say real words of gratitude for their systems, their own experiments, the situations that they provided, the monasteries, and the preservation of the teachings. So that's all I really have to say. We wouldn't have this stuff to study if it wasn't for the monastic communities that created it, produced it, explored it, did countless thousands, probably millions of hours of practice to help us get have these things today. So thank you very much. That's all.
Yeah, thank you, Daniel. Rigu Toku Rinpoche, please.
Thank you very much. I have not studied almost nothing from the science, so I may not be able to say anything about science. I've been a monk since I remember, and so therefore I have been trying to practice a little bit, but I am a very lazy monk. The Buddhist point of view, we have mainly three things, mainly three trainings, the training on conduct, training on wisdom, and training on meditation. And all these three kind of supposed to help each other. And especially meditation is basically there are two things. One is concentration, and what Dada has been talking about, the meditation. But there's a wisdom part of it, which is to try to understand and see how the things are and how I experience myself. And so therefore, it's a little bit like, therefore sometimes this is called, science of the mind. And therefore, it's basically an experiment, a study, investigation. And then what we call meditation is actually trying to bring that understanding to our own experience. And therefore, it's not only, something that is believed or something that we understand intellectually, but something that we actually experience and thereby transform ourselves. So therefore, I'm not saying I'm very advanced in that, but that is how I understand about meditation.
Thank you, Rinpoche. And we'll go to Miguel Ferris. Miguel, you can begin.
I would start to say something about the commonalities. I agree that there is something similar between the religious traditions of meditation and science, in the sense that there is a spirit of experimentation, right? So you're trying out different things and you're seeing what works and what doesn't work. So both science and the meditation traditions are working with that. They're working with the body and the mind. There is also a search for a truth, although the terms of how you arrive at this truth will vary substantially. And the models of the mind we have in Western science are very different from the models of the mind you have across the various spiritual traditions. There are things both within the religious and the scientific traditions which are more problematic. And so there's also space for misconceptions. And I'll give just a couple of examples of misconceptions which can arise both from the religious traditions and science. So for instance, I have heard someone in India, I mean, who has lots of followers, saying that if you do this kind of yoga or meditation, this will treat all your problems. It will heal HIV, it will heal cancer, it will heal whatever. And we know that there's actually not evidence that a single method can heal all potential illnesses. On the other hand, there's from science also very particular misconceptions. Just to give another example, 10 years ago, there was a paper published in a well-known journal, Science, that most religious meditation traditions believe that you find happiness by focusing in the present moment. And anyone that knows something about religious studies would know that that's actually nonsense. Most religious traditions, including Buddhism, are not particularly interested in the present moment. So this is a misconception which has arisen from a very narrow and biased understanding of what the meditation traditions are trying to do. I'll stop there.
Great, thank you very much, Miguel. So let's go into a discussion about meditation and science. And as Miguel was pointing out, the two different, I wouldn't say traditions, let's say perspectives, actually have different models for looking at what this is. And Miguel, I'm gonna stay with you because you recently, or you have a book called, you co-authored a book called The Buddha Pill, Can Meditation Change You? And I believe you also talk a lot about mindfulness and the limits of mindfulness. Buddhist tradition tells us that mindfulness is helpful in all things. What are the benefits and limits of mindfulness from your perspective?
So as everyone is aware, there has been a growing body of research for the last 30 years on mindfulness. Also on another technique, transcendental meditation. So because there's now thousands of studies, what we usually do is we get hold of the cream of these studies, the best, the most rigorous studies, and we do meta-analysis, meaning that we crunch these data to see what are the most robust effects. So we know that mindfulness-based interventions, and there's variations on these, so it's not just meditation, it involves other psychotherapy techniques. But it seems to be moderately effective with things like depression and anxiety. On the other hand, we know that it's not particularly effective for things like sleep disorders or addiction. And on the other hand, we can think of how strong are these effects compared to other forms of therapies or even physical exercise. And the answer is, well, actually, when you put together all these studies, and we're talking about statistics, it doesn't mean that it might work better or worse for some individuals, but we can't really say that overall, these mindfulness-based interventions are better than other forms of psychotherapy, for instance.
Great, so you're talking about some situations it's helpful, other situations it's not necessarily helpful.
Yeah, so it depends on the kind of symptomatology that we're talking about. So this is what we know now about the the evidence for mindfulness-based interventions for mental health and physical illnesses.
Great. Dada, you want to comment on this?
Well, I tend to agree with Miguel. I'll take a different approach as far as I think your comment was about the limits of mindfulness. Can I
Benefits and limits.
Okay, benefits. Benefits are that it brings more people to looking for some inner life and some happiness that's not just material. And I could talk a lot about that, but I'll leave that for now. Limits of mindfulness might apply to the limits of many types of meditation. I, of course, am a meditation teacher. I've been meditating daily for many, many years. Wouldn't go without it. But I do see that sometimes people, whether in mindfulness or other things, like Miguel mentioned, one or two other types of meditation, people think it's the easy way out. And they may not realize, and I find this with some of my students, they may not realize that it's hard work to learn Aikido, to learn a new language, to learn meditation, to be a doctor, as Daniel is. These things can be very rewarding if you can put in the work, the hours, shall we say. And so I find the difficulty is that people say, yeah, so-and-so got so much insight, bliss, et cetera. Why isn't it happening to me? So the limits are perhaps in a couple of words that, the benefits are great. It can help you in many, many ways in life. But the limits are that people may overassume, if I can make up a word. Yeah.
Great. Perfect. 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 Daniel, what do you think? Is mindfulness helpful in all things?
Plenty of things certainly benefit from paying attention, obviously, though the quality of attention can vary a lot, and skillful distraction even can sometimes be super useful in certain situations, as well as the ability to say, go to sleep. But I think mindfulness, one, politically was super useful because by basically narrowing the bandwidth about which they discussed meditation, making this very relatively innocuous, what they said was side effect free, relatively small dose thing, they met and saying it didn't have any side effects was, I've heard plenty of talks and read papers and stuff where they say this stuff doesn't possibly do anything bad to you. And as well as downplaying the high end of what meditation can do, so they sort of ignored all the interesting effects that meditation at what you might say the monastic level sometimes, or even just the daily life level for certain unusual individuals who can get into these experiences on relatively low doses. They managed to get it into the clinical mainstream, and they did that, it's been there for, 40 something years now, since the, early 80s, basically, late 70s. And that was a miracle, right? Because it sort of broke something of the glass ceiling of scientific materialism and brought some spirituality. And so I think politically, that was a really interesting move. And I think it allows now for the possibility of studying the deeper end, both of what can go very right and what can go very wrong, and exploring something of the non-linearity of the path, bringing a more sophisticated understanding to the whole question of what meditation and mindfulness can do, particularly at higher doses, but not always. And so, I think that the time where it makes sense to totally ignore both the high end and the low end and the strange and the weird and all of the things that, those of us who have done deep meditation are familiar with, I think that time has kind of passed, and I think the world is sort of ready for it. So I hope that the world of science and clinical practice starts expanding its horizons to look at more of the range of what can happen, and to have more realistic discussions about what can possibly happen. So if you were going to ethically discuss the risk, benefits, and alternatives to meditation with patients or clients or people undergoing therapy or people just wanting to develop themselves from a positive psychology point of view, to be able to explain these are the more interesting things it can do on the positive end, right? The sort of higher stages of meditation, awakening, etc. These are the risks if you go into some of the unstable periods. And by the way, the path is not linear. and to be able to actually study various techniques and to actually compare them. I think that's one of the things that science is going to do a great job of, because nearly every meditation technique says, oh, we're the best, you know, we're the safest, we're the most amazing. And yet, I think that the science is going to have something to say about that if properly and even-handedly applied to those sorts of questions in terms of what their actual effects and possible adverse consequences are.
Yeah, thank you, Daniel. And Rinpoche, how do you see the benefits and maybe even the limitations, or as Daniel was saying, sometimes the risks of meditation on some meditators?
I think it is not like that. You know, the main thing is, you can't say meditation or mindfulness as one thing.
Right.
There are many different approaches, and there are many different ways of doing meditation. And, you know, the mindfulness, actually, what we call mindfulness now is a little bit change of the word from meditation to mindfulness, because meditation is more spiritual and mindfulness a little bit more secular. But the real mindfulness, actually, when we say mindfulness from Buddhist point of view, it is just, you know, being mindful. You know, it's just being aware of what's going on. And that is actually a tool. That's the only tool we have if you want to, you know, train anything, you know. Whether it's how we act, how we think, how we speak, whatever we do, if you want to, you know, train it in a certain way, we need to have the mindfulness, because unless we are aware what's going on, what I'm doing or what I'm reacting and, you know, how things are, then I can't train. So therefore, it's you know, that's why in eight, Eightfold Path, the mindfulness is separate from meditation. And this mindfulness applies to all others, because it's seen as a medium to do meditation, but not only meditation, but everything else. I think it is like this, you know, you can't say that this is the shortcomings of meditation or this is the benefits of meditation. Everything has also the same with this, you know, psychoanalysis, psychotherapy, and all kind of things. Everything has its benefits. And, you know, if you do it in a proper way, if you have a right kind of guidance, and, you know, if that particular method is suitable for the person at that time, then it will be very useful and it will be helpful. But if not, then it will not be. So I don't think it is right to say and understand that, you know, this one method is good for everybody and will cure all the things. Nobody actually said this before also. You know, one can say that this particular meditation or this particular mindfulness is very good for me and the best for my practice. But I can't say that this is good for everything and for everybody at any time. You know, this, then if you say that, there's a little bit something wrong with it.
Yeah. Can I add something to that, Miles?
Absolutely, please. I just want to tell any of the panelists, if you want to interject, raise your hand or jump in, feel free. Miguel.
So I would completely concur with what Ringo Tulku has just said. And one of the downsides of the current hype of mindfulness, if it has made meditation techniques more widely known, on the other hand, it has biased our understanding of meditation in various ways. One is what Ringo Tulku was talking about, the idea that this technique works for everyone and it will benefit everyone. So it's actually narrowing our attention to the extraordinary variety of the techniques, the contemplative techniques, and also the different aims associated with these, which vary in extraordinary ways from various schools of Taoism to Christianity, Islam, Hinduism. So that's absolutely right. And I mean, within these contemplative traditions, it's also very, very clear. I mean, two things. First, that we tend to have, I mean, some psychologists and clinicians have a very benevolent and naive idea about experiences arising from meditation. Now, meditation is creating a different state of consciousness. And the way these are interpreted very widely, right, which is why all these traditions don't take these experiences for granted. There's ways of understanding what these mean, and if this person is doing things in the right way or in the wrong way. And then there's, for over 1,000 years within the Buddhist and other traditions, there's various discussions about doing meditation in the wrong way and leading to potentially negative outcomes. But I hope that discussions like this will actually change the public perception to want to know more about meditation in general, and not just this very particular and biased understanding of even mindfulness. As Ringu Tulku was saying, it's a different understanding from the tradition of what mindfulness is.
Fantastic. So let's flip the question. And what are the benefits that science brings to contemplative practices or meditation practices? And what are the limitations? What is the event horizon of science in terms of how to understand these practices? Dada, would you like to make a comment here?
The event horizon, what are the limitations of science?
Science towards the mystical experience or towards contemplative practices?
Okay, one thing that Miguel was just saying triggered more or less a response to what you're asking now is that I think I'm going to maybe turn around your question a little bit, but I think it's important that science, not ignoring your question, but I think it's important that science makes more effort, puts more resources into studying meditation. There are a good amount of resources about the brain now, neuroplasticity, which I'm sure Miguel knows much more about than I do, and Daniel, I'm sure. But if we could understand really how meditation works, for example, someone has a mantra, someone else has a breathing practice, whatever, but someone has a mantra. And if science could understand how and when does that affect a certain part of the mind, I think it could go a great way in the future toward helping us with what we call mental illness, fixing problems like that. I'm a meditation teacher, as is Ringu, and I know that someone may come to me who's a little bit like this, if you see my body language, and I'll give all respect to them as I would to anyone. But I, at some point, I'll realize I can't really help them. They can go into meditation after they've solved these initial problems. So then I would turn them over, so to speak, to a psychotherapist or a doctor. But as I say, if doctors, if medicine, if science will go more into studying how meditation really works, I think both disciplines can grow a lot.
Yeah. Beautiful. And Daniel, I'm going to pass this question to you, but I just want to remind the people that are in the webinar, if you have questions, open the Q&A, put the questions, and then vote on the questions, because towards the end, we're going to take questions from the participants. Daniel.
Well, I think science as a method is really interesting, but culturally is pretty complicated. And so science itself is actually going to have to slightly get over itself and its materialist fixations, right? And I think get a lot more sort of pragmatic, ontologically agnostic, and just curious, as well as be careful with alignments with various traditions. So when I look at most of the science, I see a lot of problems that scientists either have allied with a specific tradition, sort of then biased their studies towards reinforcing its, hegemony or whatever, or they've taken the position that all of this is sort of nuts or crazy or, not really doing much that's interesting, or, a lot of the stuff isn't kind of real or whatever, and then biased in that direction. And particularly like the clinical world, there are literally no diagnostic codes for any of the stuff, either the highs or lows or strange things. There's no guidance on how to manage any of this stuff in any textbooks of, say, emergency medicine, emergency psychiatry, if people come in with some of the more interesting effects that happen. So the functional sort of clinical understanding is pretty underdeveloped. And I think that science is going to have to recognize some of its sort of own biases and limits first to do this well. But I think once it does that and becomes a little even more objective than it currently thinks it is, I think that the comparison of various techniques and traditions, various predisposing factors for either good outcomes or bad outcomes, a real deep understanding of where we've come from. So like going back to the old texts and looking at all the techniques, you know, prospective longitudinal clinical trials of various techniques for various types of people to try to produce various effects, and to become vastly more comfortable with something other than what they've grown used to, which is mindfulness, which again is packaged as is very, very narrow bandwidth technique in terms of the range of techniques and effects and the way it advertises itself. And I think it's, you know, it's we're four or so decades into this now. And so I think that it's definitely time for science to feel more comfortable expanding out. And I think actually sort of social sciences such as anthropology and sociology are going to actually help that, because, you know, we get a lot of neuroscience focus in this and statistics, but I actually think some of the social sciences are going to be super helpful for understanding the needs of scientists, like what it is that makes them either comfortable or uncomfortable studying these things, as well as the needs of the more specific religious and spiritual traditions, what will make them more comfortable feeling studied and what are their actually needs in these kinds of processes. And to do that sort of social science anthropological work, I hope will help bridge some of the still pretty obvious gaps between the deeper neuroscience statistical and the religious spiritual end.
Great. And Rinpoche, what do you see as some of the benefits and limitations of science? I know that Tibetan Buddhism and the Dalai Lama and many of the traditions in Tibet, the Tibetan schools, have actually cooperated with science in researching meditation. Do you see benefits and limitations there?
Yes. His Holiness Dalai Lama, you know, is very much involved in a discussion between science and Buddhism, you can say. And I have also had the opportunity to be some of the discussions with these scientists and His Holiness Dalai Lama. I have been to some of the other scientific, you know, like Mind and Life Institute in America, where the scientists present, you know, the scientific evidences and studies, and it all went over my head. I could understand almost nothing. And I was supposed to be there to react, but I couldn't because I didn't understand what was going on. But when I was with His Holiness Dalai Lama, I could understand a little bit because the scientists were trying to explain things at, you know, the way that, you know, just a kind of layperson would understand. I think this is, you know, His Holiness Dalai Lama often said, and you know, this is his kind of policy, that it's not that we, you know, the Buddhism has to be approved by science, or, you know, science has to be accepted by Buddhism. It's not like that, but we have to discuss. We have to, you know, openly exchange and open our minds. I think that's something very, very important. And because, you know, there is, I think, a lot to learn for the meditators or spiritual paths or Buddhism, whatever you call it, from, you know, from the studies of the scientists. And, you know, because science is actually, you know, in the right way, if it is, you know, it's not that maybe all scientists are like that, but you know, it has to be very open-minded, and you know, have to just find whatever is the truth and search for the truth without bias. And actually, the spiritual path has to be like that also. It has to be, you know, searching for the truth, and you know, and experimentally and experientially, and not, you know, stuck in my, this is my way and this is my, what my teacher said, so it must be like that. You know, especially Buddha said very clearly that, you know, you don't have to believe because I said it. You have to experiment, and you have to, you know. So therefore, if this approach, I think if we, you know, this is, I think, the right time, I think, now, because the biases are a little bit, you know, thinning out. And, you know, there's some element that some scientists are able to kind of a little bit, you know, probe in meditation and other spiritual traditions or experiences, and then, you know, this, you know, the meditators and others are also becoming a little bit more interested in, you know, the scientific approach and, you know, the way you do. Actually, science has a very methodical way of study and things like that, which I think is very useful. But sometimes I feel that, you know, sometimes there are different goals also a little bit. And this is also sometimes a little bit of something important to understand. For instance, for this psychologist or psychotherapist, I feel that, you know, the main goal is try to make us ourselves to become, if you use a kind of Buddhist term, a healthy samsaric mind, you know, to make ourselves a healthy samsaric mind. And meditation is not just that. It might have, you know, some elements or some methods to bring more kind of healthy samsaric mind, but its main aim is to go beyond samsaric state of mind. So therefore, it kind of, you know, in a way, you know, the meditation, the from the spiritual point of view, the meditation starts where this, you know, the psychotherapy or, you know, science have kind of finished, you know. So this also is one area, but then there, I think lots of things that could be, you know, that could be, there are lots of, like Dada said, you know, there are lots of, I think, areas where we can do lots of research. And I think when, if this, you know, this area is open, then I think it will be very good for the humanity.
No, thank you, Rinpoche, and thank you for bringing in the openness of inquiry. And I think that this panel is beautifully reflecting that. When we say science, so far we've been kind of walking a thin line between, let's say, neurology and psychology. And I wanted to specifically ask about psychology right now, because the back in the 80s, I think it was Dr. Jack Engler, a famous psychotherapist, American psychotherapist and meditation teacher, famously said, before you can become nobody, you have to be somebody, you know, pointing to the stability of ego development before you dissolve into emptiness. Would any of the panelists, like, who would like to jump in here? Anybody? Yeah, Daniel, please just jump in.
Okay. I have really mixed thoughts on this. And I think the definition of somebody is super complicated. I think that's one of the more interesting things. And is does somebody mean you have a tolerance for, I mean, and also what would you look at nobody, right? That really nobody means, like, you know, sort of dissolving into emptiness, awakened mind, you know, deconstructing the fundamental sense of, you know, a central doer, knower, controller, beer, you know, thing that's actually doing all this, right? So we've suddenly talked about pretty advanced stuff from a certain meditative point of view, right? Which most people at the time actually weren't really thinking about at you know, in the early 80s when it came to a lot of stuff related to clinical therapeutic meditation. So just, and then somebody, does somebody mean that you have a tolerance for pain? Does it, you know, and you can just kind of handle, like, if things get unpleasant, like sort of ego strength in the classic sort of Freudian sense, right? Which is ironic, you know, sometimes linguistically when you, in these contexts. Or is it that, you know, being somebody means you've really accomplished things, right? That you've really, that you have life success, that you've really, you know, become self-actualized in a way that you can, you know, translate your desires to actions. Does it mean that you have a really confident sense of who you are and what you want and all of that stuff? Like, what does the word somebody mean? It's interesting, as I worked in emergency departments, one of the things you begin to realize is that some of those concepts need to be sort of seriously challenged. There was this one emergency department I used to work in, which was very affluent population, and engineers, extremely educated people, you know, doctoral degrees, highly sort of accomplished people, very sort of somebody from a certain sense. they had an extraordinarily hard time often handling even small upsets, small bruises, small injuries. It could cause them to just sort of freak out. So they were kind of somebody, and yet they had this sort of odd fragility about them. And I remember, like, you know, and then I worked in another emergency, actually a few emergency departments, where we had very large sort of, you know, poor, disenfranchised, homeless populations, et cetera. It was amazing the stuff that they could weather and handle and just kind of roll with, because they were used to adversity and used to tough circumstances, right? And some of these people could suffer tremendous, you know, physical injuries or tragedies and have a sort of a resilience about it. And so does it mean resilience? Does it mean accomplishment? Like, you just have to be kind of careful with some of those words, because I think it's actually something more about a tolerance for letting go, a tolerance for rolling with changes, a tolerance for having feelings and not freaking out about them. But that's not really, that's sort of different from how most people would think of the word as somebody sometimes, just to sort of put that out there.
Great. Anybody else? Yeah, Dada, please. You open your mic, Dada.
Yeah, as I said before the conference started, I spend half my life turning off my mute. Two words. I appreciate much what Daniel said, and I'll take, of course, a different perspective, not the scientific. Somebody is the word, the key word, and also thrown in there was the word ego, and they're fairly familiar. The word ego in much of the world, at least the English-speaking world, oh, he's got a lot of ego, and you don't really appreciate that about the person. But then I often think about the origin of the word ego, which is from Greek. In Greek, you might say ego. That's how it's normally said in the Greek language. It simply means I am. So from the point of view of meditation, the idea of I am is partly to understand that I am somebody. Who am I? What do I do? What can I do? What can I not do? What do I need to improve about myself? What do I need to give to the world to make the world a better place? And many, many other comments would come up there. But spiritually, from my tradition of yogic tantra, tantric yoga, the idea of ego is to expand my own limited sense of self, to understand that I am part of what my teacher might call the great entity, whatever that means to you. It has nothing to do with a religious or a cultural framework. So the idea of somebody, and Daniel made some very good comments here. I would say the idea of establishing who I am as somebody is to understand partly myself, my limitations, my capabilities, but also to take a lot of time to understand who am I really? What is the bigger sense of me? And I think that's all I need to say.
Miguel, you want to jump in here?
Yeah, just a couple of things, particularly what you were saying about psychotherapy in relation to meditation. There's long discussions in transpersonal psychology, for example, on this. I remember years ago reading a dialogue between Ken Wilber, who's one of these major transpersonal psychology figures, and the meditation teacher about the differences and similarities. I think there are some important differences in the sense that meditation is not there to sort you out emotionally. It's not what it's been developed for. And there may be some misunderstandings about that. I don't think that meditation is there to heal your attachment problems in your early childhood, for example. And I have never come across any evidence showing that it does that. But on the other hand, I mean, perhaps the sense of self that we have today is much less robust than the sense of self we had 200 or 500 years ago, because all our social worlds have shifted so much for the last 200 years that our minds have become homeless, as a famous sociologist has said. So in that sense, perhaps some people are using meditation to try to find some sense of security, when traditionally meditation was developed to try to do something very, very different. So there, I think we're looking at systems which sometimes overlap because there is some healing associated to them, but ultimately they are different, or originally and ultimately.
Well, so do you think it's important? Because, for example, in Burma, where I used to practice, there was this kind of little secret around the monastery and the meditation center, that the quickest yogis, just the yogis whose practice organically unfolded, the quickest were young, teenage Burmese girls. They were from that culture. They were Buddhist by birth. Their minds were not so, they didn't have Facebook back then. They were very, and yet they weren't highly developed, let's say, psychologically, because they were still teenagers, but they, so forget about the maturity, but what about stability of psychology, of a person's psychology and meditation? Do you see a correlation, a necessary correlation? Yeah,
that's another different question. That's really interesting. I'd like to hear Dada and Ringo Tulku on this. From a psychological perspective, it's a tense discussion, because you'd expect the person who is very spiritually evolved, if we may call it that, to be also very psychologically sound. But I mean, within the history of these traditions, and I'm thinking of the Christian tradition of saints, for example, there are clear examples of people who had mental health problems, Catherine of Siena, for instance, and who were also regarded as saintly characters. So you don't need to be psychologically healed or sane to be a holy individual within some of these traditions.
Right. And Rinpoche, would you like to comment on this? Yes, please.
You know, I think when people say sometimes, you know, that the meditation is for kind of to selflessness or emptiness or things like that, I think there is sometimes a little bit of misunderstanding. I think, you know, it's not like, you know, these terms like emptiness and selflessness and things like that, I think has to be understood in the right perspective. It's not like I don't care anything about myself. It's not like that. And it's like, I'm nobody completely, you know, that's also not like that. You know, I think trying to see what exactly you are from an experience point of view, you know, and it is not, you know, it's sometimes it is said it's, if you say I am, if you say I'm not, you know, it is not, both are not so, you know, correct, you know. So this is not, you know, it's a little bit complicated and it's sometimes misunderstood very much, I think. And I think this is, you know, like different stages and different, like for instance, like from the psychological point of view, you know, you try to make person, you know, like there are lots of people who don't like themselves, you know, don't feel themselves, or, you know, don't have like strong kind of sense of well-being for yours. So if that's like that, then I think you have to give them a sense of, you know, I care for myself, I have to work for myself, I have to, you know, take care of myself. That sense has to be there, you know. And I've heard that some therapies try to make people angry. And so they, you know, they become angry. And then when they become angry, they have a sense that I am there. And, you know, I'm somebody and, you know, I don't want to be hurt. And that is, I think, a positive way, path. You know, first, I think I have to have that. Because when we talk about, you know, compassion also, you know, if I have to be compassionate or kind to somebody, I think first I have to care for myself. You know, why I have to be compassionate? Because I know that I want myself to be free from suffering and problem and, you know, difficulties. And therefore I want others also to be like that. If I didn't have that sense that I want to be okay, I want to be free from problems, then I can't have an idea that I want others to be free from problem also. So it's not really, you know, I don't care for myself. When we are talking about compassion, it's just, I extend myself to others. You know, as much as I want good things for myself, I want others also to be good. So it's like, you know, as Dada was saying, in a way, that we extend ourselves to a larger kind of, and if possible, limitlessly. So therefore, you know, I think some of these terms are sometimes misunderstood many times, I think.
Yeah, fantastic. So I just want to again remind everybody in the webinar room, if you have questions, please write them in the Q&A. If you write them on the chat, I won't see them, but if you put them in the Q&A, I'll bring them in about another 10 minutes. We're going to start taking questions. So let's talk to first the scientists, which Daniel and Miguel, you're representing that today. What benefits has the contemplative traditions brought to science? And then we'll flip it for the monastics. Daniel or Miguel, who wants to go first? Yeah, Daniel?
Okay. So I think the contemplative traditions bring a tremendous amount, right? So they've studied aspects of the mind and experience and phenomenology and ways to relate to it and modify it that are, you know, 3,000 years or so advanced from Western science largely. I mean, you have some of sort of the German phenomenologists, and it's not like everybody hasn't experienced emotions, and you have some of the, you know, but in terms of a sophisticated understanding of the moment-to-moment nature of experience, of things related to perception, of the vast range of what you can do with attention, of the various experiences that might be somewhat unusual or interesting that you can cultivate, the very, very different ways that you can relate to just ordinary experience, and the potential of what happens if you do that in very, very high doses rather than, say, 20 minutes here or there. Those are things that the monastic traditions have explored, you know, with staggering amounts of data over millennia. And so in some ways are vastly ahead of science, and yet lacking statistical methods, lacking some other sort of critical methods of analysis, sometimes have gotten sort of fixated on their own doctrines. And there's clearly been some sort of ossification at points, some sort of almost rot, some things that have gotten into the literature, you know, maybe in some period of time that sort of made some cultural sense at the time, that then just sort of became parts of those canons that didn't get questioned. And I think the scientific method could actually really help the traditions refine and sort of clean up a lot of the amazing work that they've done and help translate it forward to a culture that and time that really does seem to demand a lot of the time answers and statistics and numbers and sort of secular translations, and yet also is looking for some sort of spirituality and depth, because consumerist materialism clearly only goes so far to satisfy. And so I think there's this tremendous hunger and need for meaning and myth and magic and the deeper end of spiritual exploration that the contemplative traditions can bring to science, which can obviously at times be unbelievably sort of harsh and dry and tedious and all of those things. So there you go.
And Miguel, how has the contemplative traditions benefited science from your perspective?
I would agree mostly with what Daniel has said. I just say that we have scientifically only just really started to this adventure, and I'm concerned that we might kill it before we go any deeper into it.
Wow.
Because we have become interested in this because we have culturally become more interested in different states of awareness. Our lives, our culture has constrained a lot our usual spectrum of consciousness. We tend to experience ourselves in very, very limited ways. And there's lots of interesting studies showing how we deal with mental health problems in different ways. So, for example, in India, although the healthcare is more limited than in rich Europe, for instance, the rates of dealing positively with things like schizophrenia are as good as in rich Western Europe. And that has to do with the attitude. They're much more permissive of allowing differences in your state of consciousness than we are. We have become very, very rigid, puritanical, I think, probably a Protestant heritage. And bringing the meditation science, I mean, sciences into Western science has kind of opened up just a little bit of how much more interesting and diverse and deep our minds are. But we run the risk of suffocating that richness because we want to get results quickly and we don't have the expertise often or the openness. I mean, we still have our colonial heritage. Let's not forget that. So we try to get hold of something, we adapt this, we simulate, and we're doing something like we want them to take this adaptation and take it back to the East and say, this is the proper scientific method. So I'm afraid in that sense that we might be suffocating something before we get hold of its interesting possibilities.
Okay, fantastic. Now I want to flip the question, and then we'll start to bring in questions from the participants. What benefits? How has science impacted the contemplative traditions? Dada, would you like to begin?
I said a little bit about that in my opening statement, in that meditation does use a laboratory, which is mainly the human mind, and also experience how certain meditations do affect our daily life. That's been going on for a long, long time. But meditation, as Rinpoche was saying also, or more so than me, there's many types of meditation. The meditation that I practice and that I teach has used the, you might say, soft science for many millennia. Soft science because we don't have test tubes, we don't have computers, that type of thing. But I see today that I think many meditation practices do need to become more scientific in the sense of research, replication, observation, that type of thing, instead of saying this works, because it doesn't always work the way that you think it does, as other speakers here have said. So some sort of scientific method in the sense of proof does need to be there to help meditation to evolve, not only meditation, but things related to meditation, yoga, exercises, yoga asanas, things like that. So science can be very beneficial to meditation. Yeah.
Yeah, thank you, Dada. And Rinpoche.
Yes, I think, the discussions, you know, the meeting of the science and the maybe science of the mind, maybe you can call it, or spirituality, you can call it, is, I think, very helpful for both sides, because it's kind of, you know, it opens the mind, and you know, what has been, like, Buddhism has been for more than 2,000 years, it has been practiced, and then sometimes these things become like, as Dada was saying, you know, and others were saying, it becomes like a tradition, you know, this, you do this, and then this, and then this, and that's it, and you know, and sometimes it is difficult to break out of that, you know, that this particular thing, first you do and then you do this, is it really, you know, maybe it works in some society, but it may not work in other societies because it's a culturally different and different ways of thinking. But this has never been the intention. The intention was that, you know, different people needs different approaches and different methods. So if those things become very rigid, then it doesn't work. So therefore, you know, the opening of the mind and a little bit of a, you know, a sense of research, because so far, you know, the meditations have been very personal. So everybody does their own meditation. And you know, nobody knows what you are doing except maybe your teacher, or one or two of your, you know, your friends, and then, you know, whether it went very well or it went not good, or, you know, how much progress you made is you know, it's not really, you know, there is no journal or there is no research or there is no, you know, nothing, you know, no studies. So therefore, this kind of things is, I think, would be very helpful. And also nowadays, at least so far, these kind of things have come, you know, like meditators are brought to the lab, you know, their brains have been, you know, explored and things like that. And so this is a little bit of a kind of a, you know, a good exchange, I think. And I think there is much more scope for that. And of course, this is, as Miguel was saying, it's very important that you don't make it like, you know, this is the Western style thing and that's it, and or something like that, you know. This is the scientifically approved one, because it can't be like that, because anything has to be very, you know, individual to individual. And, you know, all different, it's very different from each person, what is needed, each culture, what is needed, you know, each situation, what is needed. So therefore, I think it is very important that we need to learn that. Actually, it's like, you know, not give a kind of kind of umbrella to everything, you know, like this is meditation, this is mindfulness, and that's it. And all meditation is under that. It's not, I think this is something, you know, the varieties is very, very important. And, you know, all different kind of varieties has its own qualities, its own, you know, its own contributions. And this is something I think very important to understand. And this is something I think the modern society has become very, a little bit very more, what can you say? Small-minded or fixated, you know, this is my way of thinking and this is good for everybody and everybody should do that kind of, you know? And if somebody says I'm wrong, you know, I have to fight against him or something like that. I think this has to go somehow. And when that happens, then I think it's very useful, because India has a little bit of that even now, you know, like you can see lots of different things happening and, you know, and there are good things in it. There are not so good things in it. You know, some people like it, some people don't like it. Some things are right and some things are not right, but it's okay. So therefore, you know, I think there can't be anything which is good for everybody and, you know, for everything. So this, I think, this kind of variety and acceptance of varieties and understanding and appreciation, respect for that variety is something that, you know, the world has to, I think, cultivate.
That's beautiful. And I will ask a question towards the end. In the spirit of this open exploration, where do you see this marriage or this interfacing of science and meditation or contemplative traditions? Where do you see it evolving towards? But maybe we'll save that for the end. I'm going to bring in some questions from the group. And any of the panelists who would like to take a shot at these questions, just raise your hand. Marie Gray asks, I've never heard of negative effects of mindfulness or mindfulness practices or meditation. What are the claims? What are some of the negative effects of mindfulness and mindfulness practice? Miguel, I think you're jumping in there.
I was just actually going to bring together what Ringu Tuku was saying about this. I mean, within the meditation traditions, this is perfectly acknowledged. It's only more recently that, I mean, the idea has become widespread that if something goes wrong with you, it's while you're meditating, the problem is never meditation. The problem is yourself. It can never be. And again, that's a really, really narrow-minded way of looking at
and harmful, not to mention harmful.
Yeah, no, it's just, and I'm not sure, I think this is partly coming from a medical model, which tries to find the universal basis. But look, we're now moving towards a much more individual-based model of medicine. So perhaps this might change. But I think it's partly to do with the marketing of things. Now everyone has to market oneself. Academics have become marketing people. So in that sense, their claims have to be universalist. So one of the virtues of science making, which is humility, has almost gone out of the picture because we have to be promoting ourselves and our own models. This is this has created lots of intrinsic ethical problems to how we do science. So I think, again, if we go back to the spirit of humility, it will be much better to come to a, I wouldn't call it a marriage, but I would say some kind of a constructive dialogue between these traditions. Because there's also the problem, we have to get out of our own Western mindset to be able to approach these traditions with a clear mind, because we can't read these works as if they're objective methods and treaties on how the mind works. They're all embedded in ideas, in certain beliefs, in metaphysics. You can't just go naively into them. You have really to understand the complexity of it.
Sure, Daniel?
So just to more directly answer that question, if you want a pretty deep dive answer and a real answer, I would just go to Progress or Pathology. It's a paper that's come out of the Varieties of Contemplative Experience project out of Brown and Cheetah House. So go to Cheetah House on the web and look up Progress or Pathology. And it will answer a ton of questions about this, about things reported by, you know, advanced meditators and meditation teachers from their own practices of what went wrong and things they know that can go wrong. But a super short list, wild degrees of mood instability, perceptual distortions, hallucinations, auditory and visual, energetic phenomena, whatever those are, weird movement stuff, sense of tingling or energy or power or whatever moving around the body, sleep disturbances, weird changes in the perception of self, depersonalization, derealization, dissociation, the re-triggering of trauma. That's a super short list. The list is actually much longer than that, but I would just go to that paper, Progress or Pathology, Varieties of Contemplative Experience, Cheetah House, and read.
Yeah, I will put the link to that paper, which is a great paper by my colleagues at Brown. And I will also add our own systematic review, which has just come out a few months ago, saying that the most prevalent effects are things like just anxiety and depression.
Great. And I do want to, I'm not going to answer this question. Well, there was one question about why aren't there more women on this panel? To be fair, this panel wasn't designed. At first it was just Dada and Miguel, and then it came, different people had invited. So it, in a way that was a little bit of a failure in our design. So forgive us on that it's only men on this panel, but let's move on to the next question. This is from Fabienne Peziu. She asks, how would science define it works? This is extremely relative to what you want to measure. How about the limits of science in that? Can science really measure that it's working? Let's go to either Dada or Rinpoche.
Okay, I think that, as I said, meditation has its own type of science, and depending on your tradition of meditation, and as we've said, there are many types, the teacher, the guru of that tradition, the teachers of that tradition may say that if you reach a certain type of expression or awareness, then it's working. But there's broader things also. In my meditation practice, other meditation practices, people may go through a lot of difficulty. They may have anger coming out. They may have worries coming out that they never knew of before. If it's carefully dealt with in a way, that's a benefit, that's a sign that the meditation is working. But one thing is you need, the student needs to have a proper guide. The teacher needs to be educated in some of these things, and the student needs to be listening to the teacher, and then they can know if it's working or not. But it's part of it is cultural also. Some things may be cultural bound, but it seems like it's not working, to turn the question around a little bit. Someone may be dancing in the streets, and in the American culture, they're crazy, but in the Indian culture, oh, that person's in a lot of happiness, a lot of bliss. So part of it is culture bound, and part of it is knowing the listening to your teacher and having a good teacher.
That's all. So Rinpoche, you'd mentioned before that meditation is about going beyond, transcending the ego, the sense of self. Can science measure that?
I don't know, but maybe
not in the lab.
But yes, in a way, you know, there are some things you can measure, I think, also, but some things not. But then maybe they will find out if you do some more research, you know, how to do that. But that's maybe important, maybe not important. The thing, I think it is, you know, like, it's about, you know, as I said earlier, you know, what kind of meditation or what kind of instruction is given to what kind of person, and how that person tackles that, you know, or works on that is very important, I think, you know, in everything. You know, sometimes people with some state of depression has to, you know, concentrate very strongly on something, and then it becomes difficult. You know, it becomes more difficult because then that person is very, very sensitive already. And then, you know, you become even more sensitive, and, you know, then it becomes a problem. So therefore, you know, you need to, I think the teachers need to be much more experienced and, you know, educated, and therefore, you know, some kind of research and proper training is very necessary. Actually, you know, as far as I know, as like in Tibetan Buddhism, for instance, that the meditation is taught, you know, for last more than 1,000 years, but there is nothing like, you know, you have how to teach meditation to those who are kind of a little bit imbalanced, you know, state of mind. How to teach them meditation? I haven't heard about a training of that particular thing, you know. So of course, some doctors have a little bit, you know, training on different effects of the mental disorder and things like that. And some kinds of meditations are recommended through those doctors. But, you know, the meditation masters or meditation teachers are never trained in how to deal with, you know, people with, you know, with a different kind of mental states. You know, every training that we get is about how to, you know, how to meditate in a normal state of mind, in the kind of, you know, a healthy state of mind. So these things, I think, therefore the meditation, if you want to use it for a clinical thing, I mean, this is a good thing that mindfulness have done in the last few years. You know, they brought that, because most of the people who are the founders of this mindfulness meditation and things like that, like you know, Paul and all these others, they are, you know, they are doctors and they are scientists, and so therefore they have that background. So I think they are more qualified to use meditation and mindfulness in these areas, you know. So that's why I think some of them were very, very helpful.
Okay, so we are coming to the end, and I want to really get in this last question. So, because I think it's important to round up our whole discussion. It's so clear that the contemplative traditions and meditation have impacted science, and it's also clear that science has impacted, this in a positive and a beneficial way, impacted meditation and the contemplative traditions. This marriage of East and West, of science and contemplative tradition, science and meditation, will continue to evolve. What are your best wishes, or how do you see that evolution happening? What are your best wishes for that? We'll begin with Miguel and just go through in order.
Oh, that's a quick one for me. I would like science to move away from just a couple of techniques and look at a wider variety of meditation exercises. That would be great. That would really change them.
Fantastic. Dada?
Well, my teacher, for example, had a great appreciation for medicine and science. And he even proposed, I won't go into the details now, but there's no time. He proposed one, shall we say, scientific thesis about the origin of life in the universe. And the reason he could do that is through partly his intuition, which comes from meditation, and also his studies of science, which came from his university days and just his, his knowledge anyway. So it's important, I feel, and very opportune for science and meditation, science and spirituality to come together. In the future, maybe it may take a century or two, we'll have a new type of science as these two things. We may have a new type of science as these two disciplines merge together.
Not to mention a new type of contemplative tradition.
Also, yeah.
Daniel.
I completely agree. And in particular, Miguel's comment, I would just like to second that rather than add something original, because I think the focus has been so narrow, both in terms of techniques and also effects, as to be at once very strategic in terms of at least getting it through the door, but now incredibly limiting. So thank you for saying that.
Yeah, fantastic. And Rinpoche.
I think this is, the dialogue is, I think, very important. Like His Holiness Dalai Lama often says, we don't need to, we need, it's not that, these scientists have to, kind of support or, approve this particular Buddhist tradition, or Buddhist tradition have to depend on the science or anything like that. But the dialogue has to go on. It has to be a kind of interest and dialogue and open the mind. And, it has to be two different streams. It doesn't need to be a marriage, but it has to be, a discussion, and it has to be, respect for each other and opening the mind for each other so that then, both can improve and both can learn from each other in different ways. And that would, that would help both in different ways, I think.
Yeah, thank you very much, Rinpoche. And just as before we close off here, I'm gonna go back. We're gonna make a round for final words, a really short closing statement, if you could. But I just like to remind everybody that this session is recorded. It's going to be available for 48 hours on the portal for the Embodiment Conference. After this session, if you'd like to go to a place, because we're drinking it from the fire hose here in the Embodiment Conference, if you'd like to have a place to unpack and debrief and talk about the sessions that you've been part of, please go to the coffee breaks. You'll find a link for that in the portal. And also the library is available for sale. The Embodiment Conference is finishing today. If you'd like to have all this wisdom for life, please go and take advantage, invest in yourself, and help support the conference. And I believe that all the links for our panelists are going to be posted in the chat. If you're interested in finding out more about them, just go to those links. And let's just go to final comments. I'll go back through the order that we're I see you on the screen. If you could just keep it to 20, 30 seconds maximum. Dada Jyoti Rupananda. You have to unmute yourself, unfortunately.
You pronounced my name correctly, thanks. As I said a moment ago, as science and contemplative practices become more merged, we will come up with a new creation of science and, as you were saying, a new creation of meditation. And this, I think, can only be good for the world. So I'll keep it short and at that, Miles. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you. Dr. Ingram.
I would also like to have the world of people who support these things take it seriously at the level of like we would take bringing a single drug to market seriously, at the level at which we, do very large clinical trials seriously, to bring a single drug to market is about $2.6 billion just through the FDA, not counting any other country. Give a tenth of that to serious meditation research, and I think we could do a ton. So it's a very materialist plug, but the bottom line is science takes a lot of money to do it well and to provide the level of security that academics require to go into taboo and controversial fields. So I would just advocate for, if you're listening to this and you have the resources to help, get in touch with some of us here. I'm sure we'd be happy to talk with you about opportunities to move the field forward.
Great. Thank you, Daniel. And Rinpoche.
I agree with everybody. Thank you very much. And I think, you know, this is important that, you know, it's just like trying to open our minds and our hearts and show respect, not only, you know, between science and spirituality, but even among the, you know, different spiritual traditions and different different cultures, different subjects, different, you know, all these things. I think it's the dialogue is very, very important these days. And dialogue in an open mind is, I think, very, very important because, you know, the world is becoming so small now, you know, like we are talking through, you know, through the world now, you know, people are in America and in India and in Europe and everyone, and we can talk to each other on one platform. So, you know, we need to, there is no boundaries now. So we have to really learn to live together as if we are in one village and, you know, really open our minds too. I think that's extremely important.
Yeah, very good. And last but not least, Dr. Ferris.
I just like to highlight that it's a great privilege to be taking this part of dialogue. I mean, when people who do the research get together with practitioners, it's like doing a potluck dish. I mean, bringing a bit of this spice from the East and this other from the West. I think we just need to have this more and more often to start to recognize both the similarities and the differences, that there are different ways of cooking our meals, and there are some things which we can understand, there are other things which are really difficult, and some things which seem obvious are not obvious. We really need to get this kind of dialogue going, I mean, for longer and to get into the deeper stuff.
Amen. Well said. Well said. So that's it for this panel discussion on monks and scientists discuss meditation. On behalf of the Embodiment Conference, I want to thank Dr. Jyoti Rupananda, Dr. Daniel Engram, Ringu Tokul Rinpoche, Dr. Miguel Ferris, the lovely Yolanda Islay, who has been our tech host on this. Thank you for everything behind the scenes, Yolanda. We couldn't do it. The whole conference wouldn't happen without you. And I'm Miles Kessler, and I want to thank you all. So.